and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And today is March 22nd, 2026. And we'll be talking about it the second hour. But for those of you who think that the Iran crisis that we'll be speaking about in the first hour is what's causing California gas prices to soar, I would hope you would go to our page. You can get to the gas issue directly at gascrisis.org, and please understand that even if that whole thing was solved tomorrow, our gas prices will continue to go up until the state figures it out. But it is a major national security issue. If you don't live in California, you should still care about it. And anyway, all that information's there at gascrisis.org.
Really quick, there is an app you can get on your phone called Gas Buddy.
Yeah.
And it will tell you the cheapest gas in California or in Redding.
Nice. Or wherever you are, I guess. I forgot that you sent that to me. I didn't play with that yet.
That'd be the least expensive gas.
Yeah, not the cheapest. Sorry. Least expensive gas.
The least high priced. Oh, my gosh. So our guest this first hour is Claire Lopez. Claire is a regular online blog contributor at Newsmax, and she's on air with One America News. And she's a founder and president of Lopez Liberty, LLC, with a mission to alert Americans to national security threats, both international and from the Islamic movement, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Marxist collaborators that we have in the country. And
I love how you put that.
Yeah, well, that's right on her deal here.
100%.
But it's kind of funny because that used to make us sound a little, you know, we're skating out on the thin ice. Yeah, not so much anymore. I think people have figured that out. She received a BA in communications and French from Notre Dame College of Ohio and a master's in international relations from Maxwell School of Syracuse University. Completed Marine Corps Officer Candidate School in Quantico, Virginia, before declining a military commission to join the CIA. So Claire has been there and done that. And Middle East is her deal. She can pronounce all the stuff, so
that's important.
We will not be saying any of the secret words. We'll let Claire do that. Claire do that for us. So we didn't talk about what we're going to discuss today. We left it up to her. And it's a target rich environment for you, Claire.
Hi, Aaron and Bill. It's so good to be with you and your audience once again.
Oh, my gosh. And for those people who have not been listening, Claire's been on with us since 2016, and I have all her shows posted on our March 22nd page for today. You've been a frequent contributor. How about that?
And happy to be.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So...
Yeah, so the Middle East, is there anything happening there?
Yeah, well...
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're watching your TV, computer screens, cell phone screens, whatever, you might have noticed a little bit of, you know, an uptick in activity over the last few weeks.
Yes. Oh, there you go. The old uptick in activity. Well, do you... I guess we could ease into it, but why do that? Do you think that this is a good trajectory we're on?
Yeah, absolutely. It's okay. A long time overdue.
Yeah.
You probably know. I mean, we've been talking with each other for, 10 years or so. But you'll probably know that I have focused on Iran in particular in the Middle East all of that time. We know from respected sources, International Atomic Energy Agency, David Albright's what they call the good ISIS, that is the Institute for the Study of Science and International Security, as well as the Iranian opposition, National Council of Resistance of Iran, with which I've been working and supporting them for, almost 20 years, I think. But from all of those sources, you know, we'll have seen that Iran has been driving for a deliverable nuclear weapons capability. There's no question about that. And as the news became more and more alarming, within the last couple of weeks, more than that, 2-3 weeks, it was understood by President Trump, thank goodness for President Trump, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, was realized that Iran was really at the cusp, right on the edge of the capability to put together a nuclear warhead. No, not just one, I should say, more like 10. And that has to do with what's been openly acknowledged by Rafael Grossi, the Director General of the IAEA and others in the U.S. government, that more than 400 kilograms, that's over 900 pounds, of highly enriched uranium was missing. And we don't know where it is. Maybe some intelligence agencies do, but we don't, and IAEA didn't. Missing, but if enriched from that 60% that the regime in Iran admits to, up to weapons grade, which is considered to be about 90, 92, 93% enriched, that would take, oh, a couple of weeks, and would be enough to make 10 nuclear warheads. That is what galvanized, that's what set off the urgency for Israel's Operation Roaring Lion and the U.S.'s Operation Epic Fury.
And what about their ability to deliver that payload? I understand their ballistic missile program was advancing rapidly. How close were they on that?
Well, exactly so. And we'll have seen that reporting just over the last few days about the Iranian regime sending a couple of its intermediate range ballistic missiles, that being around 4,000 kilometers range, in the direction of Diego Garcia, where the United States, of course, as we know, you know, has for a long time maintained a large base, military base there. Those ballistic missiles of Iran, fortunately, one just misfired and fell short en route. The other one was shot down, so never reached the targets. But the fact that those intermediate-range ballistic missiles aimed at Diego Garcia, if they had made it all the way there, would have been 4,000 kilometers. That is at least twice as far, or nearly twice as far, as anybody ever thought Iran's ballistic missiles were capable of going.
Mm.
Now, the other part of that is other open source reporting. Again, I've mentioned the National Council of Resistance of Iran. That's the Iranian opposition group, headquartered in Paris, outside of Paris, actually. But that they had been reporting in open press briefings held at their Washington, D.C. offices over the last year, 2025, which I attended, along with many other representatives, journalists, reporters of the media. And in those press briefings, the NCRI deputy director in particular of that office, Ali Reza Jafarzadeh, presented evidence repeatedly, as I said, 3-4 different press briefings that I attended, the evidence that in ballistic missile weapon sites out in Iran's far eastern province of Semnan, there were, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 ballistic missile sites, including Shahrud, Ivanaki, Sanjarian, others too, where the Iranians were working on adapting, or the final steps of fitting, warheads, not fully developed yet, but in development, nuclear warheads, to the nose cones of their ballistic missiles. This work going on at ballistic missile weapon sites. So that, too, gets to your question, Bill, and probably also caught the attention of American and Israeli leadership as to the urgency, the imminence of the threat.
Right.
Yeah, because we're just, you know, awash in, you know, Democrat hysteria that there was no reason to do this. This just came out of the blue. There, you know, what are we thinking?
Well, what are they thinking? Obviously, they were not doing their homework at all. They have not read the same totally, completely open source reporting or attended the same press briefings that many of us did. And this is what I'm talking about is all completely open source. I'm not even talking about what intelligence agencies like Mossad or CIA or any others, you know, might have collected. No idea what that would be. No access to it. But open source reporting alone would have informed anyone who cared to pay attention.
Yeah, and then, you know, along with that, the whole idea that we should have given everybody notice that we were going to do something. It's like, you know, I'm pretty sure that that is not part of anybody's battle plan.
Yeah, that was a one of President Trump's little quips there at the Oval Office meeting this past week with Japanese Prime Minister visiting the United States.
That was awesome.
That was
so cool.
Yeah, Takayuchi. He mentioned, how about Pearl Harbor? Replying to a reporter's question. He was taking questions there in the Oval Office together with Sonny Takayuchi, the Prime Minister. And that was his quip. Well, how about
because they're like, why didn't you tell everybody? Why didn't you warn everybody? Yeah.
Not thinking straight, I guess. I don't know.
The reaction on that was actually pretty funny. You could see the uh-huh. the translation and the and. You know, you got to realize after somebody says a thing like that, it's like, oh, wow.
Do you think some of those reporters are plants that are in there in the Oval Office?
Sure. That may be. I don't know this particular one or who it was, but that's possible.
Yeah, it was just sad.
The other side of this is, you know, they're saying, oh, well, we were in negotiations, but has Iran ever honored any of the agreements that they've made in past negotiations?
No, certainly not. We could go all the way back to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to which the Iranian regime remains a signatory. We can look at, more recently, the 2015 JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which was supposed to have limited the enrichment of uranium by the Iranian regime to 3.67%, and they themselves now admit they've blasted at least up to 60%. I think probably more. So no, they don't keep signatures, to agreements they have signed. But I'll mention this, and many may not realize this, but under Islamic law. To which the current Iranian regime adheres very faithfully. Under Islamic law, it is obligatory for faithful Muslims to lie to infidels in those cases in which the objective to be achieved, here, of course, jihad, is likewise obligatory.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, duh.
Yeah,
it
really looked like it was just a big stall tactic with the negotiations they had going on. They just wouldn't come clean with anything, and I think Trump just got fed up with it. It's time to act if you're not going to come to the table.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I think President Trump and his negotiators, Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner, the others, I think they tried as hard as they could to show that they were trying to negotiate in good faith and give every opportunity for negotiations with the Iranian regime to succeed. And then finally, President Trump just had enough, and he knew perfectly well, and so did the negotiators, you know, that Iran was, to coin a phrase here, just tapping them along Mm-hmm. And that was it. That was the end of that effort.
Yeah, at some point you have to call it. I mean, you know, I always go back to children and dogs. You know, if it doesn't work with children and dogs, it isn't working anywhere else either. And there comes a limit with both children and dogs where you have to
draw the line and no more.
Yeah,
and especially like we mentioned just a bit ago, you know, the intelligence, open source and otherwise, coming in about where Iran was with its nuclear weapons development and delivery systems, the ballistic missiles.
Yeah. Well, I also find it amazing that the reporting is so sketchy on the number of people that they've murdered. I immediately contacted some of the folks that we've worked with for a long time in the Organization of American Iranian Communities out here, and the OIC guys are like, they killed 30,000 people. It's like, huh.
I'm not even sure that anyone, including the regime, actually knows the true number.
That's probably true.
I'm not sure that they've counted them all, and no, actually, and certainly we don't, on the outside, necessarily know the true number either, but it was horrifically
It was
high.
Huge. I mean, it wasn't just a few. Hey, Claire, let's take a quick break, but when we come back, I know this is kind of a weird question, but... just out of curiosity, since you have a lot more time studying these guys, I'm really curious to know how you ultimately win a conflict, how you run a country, how you convince everybody to be on your team. If you're just murdering everybody, like all the guys that should be on your team, like, you don't want to be on the team, great, we'll just kill all of you. I'm curious the mindset that creates that as a strategy, I guess. We'll be right back. Our guest is Clara Lopez. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Boys, you gotta draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
I had to play that one, Claire. That was the first time Dr. Peter Pry ever laughed on our show. We played that song, and he laughed, and he said, "That is my favorite song."
Oh, we miss him.
Isn't he? Ugh, I miss him too. And I thought, oh, Claire's on. We'll play Peter's. We'll flip to Peter's special music list.
Good one. A good one there.
So, I mean, is it just? It just, there's such ideologues that they don't see that is kind of a crazy thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, you nailed it with that word. Ideologues, theocratic ideologues, true, faithful, believing, practicing Shiite Muslims. The objective of such a regime is to take power, wield power, keep power. It doesn't matter if the people are with you or against you. It doesn't matter, you know, that you have to slaughter tens of thousands of your own people to maintain that power. That's irrelevant to a leadership as ideologically committed as the Shiite Twelvers, whoever's left at this point, of the Iranian regime.
Yeah. So in your estimation, do the people eventually just stop fighting them and go along, or have they hit the tip? The OIAC guys think that they've hit the tipping point and that nobody's backing up on this.
The people, you mean?
Basically the revolution, right?
Yeah. No. Absolutely. I agree with their assessment. You know, this regime has now been in power for something like 47 years. Before that, it was an autocratic monarchy, again, not a democracy, but nowhere near as savage and brutal and awful as this regime that followed it with the Ayatollah Khomeini's 1979 revolution. And the people have risen up during those 47 years time and time again. We'll note that sort of geographically, ethnic minorities are located around the periphery of central Iran, if you will. So what I mean is the Baluchis are down along and across Iran's border with Pakistan, come up to the Caspian Sea, and you've got the Turkmen, you've got the Azeris up there, over to the northwest, and again crossing the border between Iran and Iraq, and that's the Kurds, very large population of ethnic Kurds, whose people are also, of course, located in Syria. And then down around to the southwest, along the Persian Gulf, is the province called Khuzestan, and the people there are Arabs. Ahwaz Arabs, they are called, and they really resent being dominated by a Persian regime headquartered in Tehran. They are not Persian, they speak Arabic, and the others too. The ethnic minorities resent being ruled from Tehran. And I'll say that together, all of those amount to maybe almost or just about 50% of the Iranian population, which is around 90 million total. And the other 50% or so are comprised of Persians, actual Persians,
mm-hmm.
Well, what, 30, 40%? And then the remaining 20%, and these are, you know, sort of really, you know, extra hypothetical, not hypothetical, but my best estimates of the population, maybe 20% of the Iranian population is Azeri. And the currently eliminated supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, was Azeri. So anyway, it's a mixed population is what I'm getting at, and many of them resent being controlled from the center by a Persian Azeri elite. And so they were never going to be okay with that situation. And many of those, Baluchis, certainly, Kurds, certainly, Ahwaz Arabs, certainly, have been armed. For a very long time.
Yeah.
In an armed revolt against the central regime. Being on the periphery, I guess it's easier to smuggle in weapons and other things to places, you know, on the periphery of the country, which has happened.
Well, and the Kurds have really been subjected to a lot of abuse for a very long time.
All of them. I mean, we can go back a lot farther even than the 79 revolution. Iran is an ancient, beautiful cultural civilization that goes back more than 2,500 years. And they were independent, they were advanced, they were a beautiful civilization until about the 640s, current era, when the armies of Islam invaded, Muslim armies of Islam invaded, and I guess, you know, the Persian Empire had been exhausted in decades of fighting against the Byzantine Empire, at that time powerful too. Anyway, they went down. The Persian Empire went down to the invading Islamic armies in the 640s by 650 or so. And they were taken over. They were never Islamic before that. Islam was imposed upon them from these invaders. They were Zoroastrian. Zoroastrianism is probably about as old, dating back as far as Judaism, the Jewish faith. And likewise, it is one true God, belief in a one true God, creator of the earth. They call him the Ahura Mazda. And from Zoroastrianism come many of the ideas that infuse both Judaism and Christianity. For instance, the difference between the juxtaposition of good versus evil, light versus dark. And right now, this past week, as a matter of fact, people in Iran who remember and still celebrate their culture have celebrated something called Chahar Shanbeh. And that is the festival of the lights, the festival of fire, really. And you'll have noticed maybe in the news that especially the young folks, they'll build little fires, not great big ones, little fires in like the parking lots of their apartment buildings or open spaces. And they, the guys do this, the young guys go running and they jump over the fire. And that is symbolic of this time of year when spring is beginning, winter is receding, and it is the symbol of going from the dark of winter to the light of spring. And indeed, Saturday, the 21st of March, this year, Saturday the 21st, was celebrated as Nowruz. Nowruz is Farsi, two words. No means new. Ruz means day. New day, or actually, new year. They celebrate the beginning of the new year with the spring equinox, the 21st of March, which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And again, this is keeping their cultural heritage alive. And they will set in their homes a table full of what they call the Haft Sin. Haft means seven. Sin means the letter S, or the sound of S, S. So seven S's. And these are items that they put on the table, all of them in Farsi beginning with the letter S. And they include things like new green shoots, a little planter of green shoots, pomegranate, chicken eggs, maybe a candle to symbolize the light, although that one doesn't begin with S, but that'll be on the table. These kinds of things keep the traditions alive. That's who the Iranian people are. And
are they allowed to do that with the people that are in charge?
Well, they're not approved of, certainly,
okay.
And there are, you know, all kinds of pronouncements from the regime about how awful it would be to celebrate Chahar Shanbeh or Nowruz. Yeah, but they do it anyway. This is how, through the centuries, they've kept alive, their own culture and civilization, which is really beautiful and shares really a lot of similarity, you know, with our own Judeo-Christian, beliefs and principles.
Yeah, it's interesting because the guys I met quite some time ago at a Marco Rubio thing down in Sacramento, and we started chatting, and they, at a coworker, and she said, "Oh, you know, Fred and Ross, you know, they're Iranians for, you know, they've been here for a long time," and they both looked at me, they're like, "Yeah, we're not, we're Persian."
Yeah, they won't make that distinction.
Yeah,
you know, obviously
they're like, "No, we're Persian."
Yeah, everybody in Iran is not Persian. Many ethnic minorities, but one of the ideas that I think certainly is talked about and maybe can be established after the fall of this regime, which is going down. But one of the ideas would be to have a kind of a federated system of government take this regime's place, with guaranteed autonomy for these ethnic minorities, so that in their own schools, for example, they can teach the children in their own language. And they would be autonomous, just like American states have our own legislatures, but send legislators to the central, U.S. Congress in Washington, D.C.
Sure.
And it could be something like that. Perhaps.
Well, they've, when I was speaking with them, two things really struck me. He said the Kurds have been subjugated for such a long time and subjected to so much really just, you know, bad things.
Abuse and oppression.
Yeah, oppression. That's kind of the word I couldn't find. Mm-hmm. And he said because of that, most of them are not literate in their own language because they're not allowed to speak it. And he said they're really angry about that. And they want their culture back. So we were chatting, and I said, well, since I am not an expert on the Middle East, I was like, well, are you going to go back to a previous time? I mean, can you put your government back to where where it worked well? And he said, you know, we have never been a democratic society. We don't. Yeah, he said, we don't know anything about it.
But it can be established because people know what it's like. Certainly,
right.
A place like the United States, although not quite the same geographically with our ethnic groups, but certainly, we have many ethnic representations among our citizens, among our people. And we have states, again, as we were saying, 50 different states, each with its own governor elected by the people of that state, each with its own legislature, but then again, all owing allegiance to Washington, D.C., the central government of the United States, and the United States Constitution that brings us all together. And that brings me to a point. After this regime falls, you know, whatever groups there are that can join together are going to have a transitional period. The NCRI, Mariam Rajavi, talks about a six-month period. I think that's reasonable. To write a new constitution and to hold elections for a new, freely and fairly elected,
right.
New majlis or parliament for Iran. That is something that is being talked about right now by many in the opposition to this regime.
How do they... So the guys that are I'm unclear. You have a whole lot of people who are loyal to this old regime that appears to be now either dead or MIA. So who are they loyal to? Like, who are they fighting? Who do they think they're fighting for? Or have they just been doing it so long they're on autopilot?
Well, you know, if you're talking about national Iranian security forces like the IRGC, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, its constituent units like the Quds Force, like the Basij. Basij are those guys all dressed in black that did a lot of the killing on the streets back in January of the protesters. You'll see them often in black, dressed as if so black, on black motorcycles and so forth. They did a lot of the slaughter. They did a lot of the killing. They're part of subordinate to the IRGC, so IRGC, and also the national police. But just as you say, Aaron, because this regime has essentially been decapitated, I mean, not just decapitated, but down to the second, third, and fourth levels, the newly appointed leadership figures last, life expectancy about 24 hours. And so what has happened is that in the 31 provinces of Iran, each of the local, provincial units of these different security forces, they have nobody giving them orders anymore. They have no one to turn to ask for direction. So they're kind of on, dead man's hand or autopilot.
They are kind of on an autopilot.
On going on old orders, perhaps. I'll kill them all. But at the same time, realizing the way things are going, as I understand it, there's a fair number of defections and people just laying, laying down their arms, going over to the people.
Yeah, I'd be looking for some casual street clothes to blend in. Maybe put my mean guy uniform in my neighbor's house.
Turn over your weapons to the people before you go change clothing.
Yeah, hope everybody doesn't know. I mean, I wonder how a deal like that works. I have to take a really quick break. When we come back, I'm not sure, has this happened somewhere before in modern time where really you had this, I don't know, like army, I guess, that was kind of self running itself, and what that how that plays itself out. How do you think it'll play itself out, maybe? Our guest is Claire Lopez. She's going to come back and tell us all about that in just 2 minutes. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
That was just a dream. That was just a dream. That's me in the corner. Spot life, losing my religion, trying to keep up with you, and I don't know if I can do it.
Yes. Well, sorry about that previous promotion. We do not promote that, actually, and have done many shows on that particular topic. So if you would like to learn more, go to the pot tab at wethepeopleradio.us. That said, back to Claire.
I had a question, Claire.
No, wait. She has to tell me about how they're going to win.
Oh.
You know, how we get rid of the autonomous army.
Okay, well, real quick, and then Bill.
Yeah.
The example that comes to mind for some of us might be the collapse in 1991 of the Soviet Union, right? And the socialist republics that formerly had been part of that, coerced to be part of that, broke away, as did the Warsaw Pact countries that had been trapped behind the Iron Curtain, broke away from domination by Moscow. You know, that's not what we're hoping will happen with Iran. I think the best outcome and what many hope for is that the country can remain united with its ethnic minorities, but again, with protections and autonomy for those minorities. The other thing about the Soviet Union, when it collapsed, the government collapsed, the geographic entity broke apart, all those republics went their own ways, but the intelligence service remained, the KGB remained in power, and it split up into its constituent parts, whereas the FSB formerly was the second chief directorate and now is the internal domestic security service of Russia, and then the SVR used to be the first chief directorate, and it is now just only the international intelligence service of Russia. So the worst possible outcome for Iran would be if the IRGC remained in control. That is not what we hope to see. So not really, a parallel situation, but something people refer to. But those are the differences, and I think we need to keep those in mind.
Yeah,
Bill, you wanted to ask something?
It's perilous.
Oh, yeah. I was just curious. What is your take on, I can't think of his name, the Shah's son, who's...
Where's the prophecy is his name.
Oh, yeah, didn't know that, Bill?
Prophecy.
Yeah, what do you think of him?
Well, he left Iran with his family in late 1978. He was just a teenager at the time. Grew up and spent the entire rest of his life in the United States. Made a very successful career as a businessman. But now is offering himself as a leader of the post-regime Iran. The thing is that, and he's a very nice man, by the way. I've been in the audience when I heard him speak. He's a good man. I think he has absolutely the, the best for Iran and the Iranian people in his heart, in his mind. But the thing is that he has not been in Iran for 47 years. He has no on-the-ground network or connections with the people of Iran, to include, many of these ethnic opposition groups, but also the Mujahideen Khalq. M-E-K, for short, stands for the People's Fighters, or Fighters for the People. That's what M-E-K stands for in Farsi, Mujahideen Khalq. That is the armed resistance, forces of the NCRI, the political umbrella group that I said before, headquartered just outside of Paris, Auvers-sur-Oise. But the MEK are the resistance forces inside the country, on the ground. In my opinion, and I don't know this, but this is my analysis, my own, I think they've probably been working with the Mossad for many years, because many of the revelations about Iran's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs have come out and been announced by the NCRI. But in any case, they've been the ones on the ground inside the country fighting, dying, going to jail, tortured, murdered for 47 years. And, Reza just doesn't have that connection or that background. So I would like to see, many would like to see all these opposition groups somehow come together, join forces. But I don't think that the Iranian people really want to go back to a monarchy. And given what has been reported, at least, about Reza's affiliations with the IRGC over these years, reports, that's probably the worst possible outcome that could possibly be for the Iranian people would be for an IRGC to remain in power with Reza as their puppet monarch.
Right.
That would just be the worst possible outcome, and everybody hopes that doesn't happen.
Well, the MEK has been, I don't know.
Vilified?
I guess we'll say, I was thinking slandered, but yeah, vilified over time. And the guys that we know are like, no, the MEK, they're the resistance fighters. They're not all those things they say about them.
Cool.
And they feel that, and I'm sure rightly so, that they were vilified just to, kneecap them.
Well, absolutely. I mean, they have been the most credible opposition force against this regime, if we leave aside maybe some of the ethnic groups, but otherwise, most credible, largest, best organized, oldest of all the resistance forces inside of Iran. And in addition, the political leadership, again, that being the NCRI, National Council of Resistance of Iran, and their leader, Madame Rajavi, Mariam Rajavi, have published, as long ago as 2006, a 10-point plan, which lays out the principles, the policies under which an NCRI-led transition government would administer Iran. And they include things, like I said before, of universal suffrage, free and fair democratic elections leading to a democrat-style republic of Iran, not the current Republic of Iran, but a democratic one. Among the 10-point plan include gender equality, autonomy for the minority groups, independent judiciary, freedom of speech, press, assembly, and so forth. Freedom of religion, no state religion, complete separation of religion and state. All of these things are in the 10-point plan, which can be found at Mariam Rajavi's own website, Mariam Rajavi, or you can go to the NCRI's website. Same 10-point plan will be found there, too. But this is their idea for the future of Iran. Now, Reza Pahlavi shares many of these same objectives and policies. The only thing is that he doesn't have the representation on the ground.
Yeah, because we didn't really hear much from him until all this started, and he popped up and wants to be the leader, and I thought, I don't know how that's going to work.
Yeah. Well, and I'm concerned as well by his open. And I'll tell you, when I say open, I mean I've been sitting in the audience at a think tank in Washington, D.C., to hear him say he wants to work with the Pazdaran, with the IRGC. And he's repeated that many times. That gives me a lot of pause.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I don't see that really happening successfully.
No.
Because they're not, these aren't people who are going to, it almost reminds me of, where
allow
they want.
Debate.
Well, when they want, like, coal miners to learn computer coding.
Yeah.
We're just going to transition them as computer coders. So maybe the IRGC, they're going to be social workers now.
The other thing about the IRGC is that even to be a member of the IRGC, which is the guardian of the revolution, it's not the guardian of the state, the nation state of Iran, or of its borders. Look at the constitution of Iran for that. It is, the IRGC is instead the guardian of the revolution, and its members are selected and they are vetted for ideological purity as a 12er Shiite Muslim. That is not the same thing as to say the Artesh. That is the word for the regular army. These are the conscripts, the regular army every day, that are not ideologically vetted for purity, as are, the IRGC. I can see the Artesh, because those are just, the regular local young men who get, conscripted into the armed forces. That's who they are, the regular armed forces of the country. But the Pazdaran, the IRGC, no, those are the guardians of the revolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, plus, I think when you've had so much oppression in the last 40 years by these people, I don't know how you can put them back in any position of power and
have the
people enforce or, be in favor of that.
No, cannot be. Cannot happen.
No.
So what's your prediction? Does this last a long time, a short time? Do they fold? Do they just fight to the end of the end of the end? What do you think?
I think they will fight to the end, but for them that could come in just a few weeks. As President Trump, and we've heard also Secretary of War Pete Hegseth say this, Marco Rubio too, and Chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dan Kane also, that it is expected that the Operation Epic Fury, together with, in close collaboration with the Israeli Operation Roaring Lion, will go on for another couple, 3 weeks, into April, let's say. But what is happening is that not only is the entire top leadership being removed, there is no more top leadership anymore, but their finances are being cut off. And that's what's happening with Karg Island. We didn't even talk about that, but that's the hub of Iran's oil export income. And not only did the United States wipe out the military forces, or defenses, I should say, the air defenses of Karg Island a bit ago, but are now moving a couple of MEUs, Marine Expeditionary Units, one the USS Tripoli and another one en route to the Persian Gulf, if need be, to take physical control of Karg Island, not to destroy its storage tanks or its piping system, its infrastructure for the oil, rather to leave that for the next government of the Iranian people, which, by the way, the Iranian people will decide for themselves what that leadership will be. But to take control of Karg Island away from whatever's left of this regime so that its financial collapse will come even sooner. And as well, now that some of our European partners are stepping up, it looks like the Strait of Hormuz likewise is going to be opened pretty soon.
Nice. Well, just so people can go reference some of this, I put links for you to the things that we were talking about. That, you know, you hear a bunch of acronyms, and it's like, wait. So the National Council of Resistance of Iran, I put a link on there for you. And I had Miriam Rajavi's 10-point plan from a previous show, so I linked that on there so people can read it. She's terrific.
I think so, too. I've met her and spoken with her previously. She is a tiny, petite lady, but a spine of steel.
And she can obviously, she's obviously got incredible security because she's still alive and she's been at a while. Claire, we have to do this again soon. I hope scheduling will allow for you to pop on with us.
We'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Just let me know.
Our guest has been Claire Lopez. You're listening to We the People. We'll be right back and talk about some fuel and stuff. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.